When speaking the very careful words of his marriage proposal, one young man said, "I'm not wealthy, and I don't have a yacht and a convertible like Jerome Green, but my darling, I love you." And she said, "And I love you too, but tell me a little bit more about Jerome Green." Now, love is sometimes sort of a fickle thing. We all have had experiences where there has been a breaking or a broken marriage, and the postmortem of it is simply, well, we didn't love each other anymore. We kind of fell out of love. To be sure, love is very important to marriage. It's kind of hard for most of us to imagine marriage without love. It seems to us the most alien of inventions, those cultures where there are arranged marriages and there is little knowledge of one another and certainly no love that is shared together. To us, we think of marriage without love as something akin to a prison house, a terrible place, a terrible relationship. But at the same time, we are tragically mistaken when we think that all there is to marriage is love. There are millions of couples who have thought that all that was necessary for a successful marriage was that they love one another, only to discover that after all of the experiences of life, that love at times runs thin, and that love for many, probably for most, maybe close to all, is not a sufficient basis for keeping a marriage relationship together. Love is, in many ways, much the product of marriage, the product of that commitment together, as it is the producer of love or of marriage and that commitment together. In fact, I think I would go so far as to say that you really cannot experience the full blossom of love until you've been married and until you have shared that commitment in marriage together. As most of you have heard me say at other times, Charlene and I have loved each other in many, many years. We've known each other all of our lives. I can't remember a time when we didn't know each other. We grew up in the same area. We attended the same church. We had many of the same friends. We've experienced many of the same things together. But somehow, when I was a teenager in high school, she appeared different than she had in the beginner department in Sunday school. And my eyes and my heart were captured by this vivacious, blonde, teenage cheerleader. And so we started dating. We exchanged rings. We went steady together. I wore her high school ring on my little finger, and she wore my ring on a chain around her neck. We wrote notes back and forth to each other. And we started to sign those notes, love, Leith, love, Charlene. And then we even came to the place where we started to say to one another, I love you. But frankly, I'll tell you that that affection of 25 years ago seems little more than infatuation by today's standards. We've grown to understand that love is more than youth. And love is more than appearance. That love is a commitment that we've made to each other for life. That love is marvelous joys that have been shared together, a combination of experiences over now many years. That love is the product of struggling through things together, through school, for me at a university and seminary and graduate school. That love was forged not just in a teenage romance and in a relationship back then. It was not just notes and initials carved on a tree. But love is the kind of thing that grows when you pray together. It's forged out of the experiences of life when problems arise. For us, it's been holding hands together through some of the fears of being caught twice in wars and conflicts overseas. It's the thing that comes from doubts and worries and uncertainties. and fears. For us, it was at one point in our marriage and in our lives, trying to battle our way out of debt together. It was some disappointments, some discouragements, some news that was difficult to handle and might affect all of our lives together. It was the joy of welcoming children into our family and into our home. It was the pains of labor rooms, the joys of nurseries, the horrors and the fears and the panics of emergency rooms, sometimes late at night. But let me tell you that now, when we put our arms around each other and when we embrace, and when we look each other in the eyes and say, "I love you," it means far more, and it means something actually quite different than it meant years ago back in the late 1950s. Because love is not just an infatuation. It's not just an attraction. Love is a commitment to one another that grows and changes and develops through the years. I suppose that there are many analogies that could be used. Some might say that love is like the spinning globe with all of its changing seasons. There are, for some in love, those warm summer days when it seems that everything is marvelous and everything is great and nothing can go wrong. And then there are also some of those cold and difficult days that come like the Minnesota winters, some of which we wonder on certain sub-zero days if we can even survive. And then there are those colorful and changing seasons of autumn that have with them the beauty of color and that smell in the air that is exciting, but with it all of the uncertainty of winter that's around the corner. And then there are seasons and cycles that are like spring, with all of its buds and all of its hopes and all of its promises of change. Every marriage, I suppose, has those cycles, has those seasons. Not as if marriages go through four of them in sequence, but marriages, like many relationships, go through them periodically. For some, there are years of summer, and then there are brief bouts of winter. And for others, there are long years of winter, and then only at last the respite of spring and the promise of summer to come. Marriage needs that kind of commitment that hangs in there through those changing seasons, through those different cycles. Marriage, as we have heard again and again, takes work and takes time. But when love grows cool and when marriage is threatened, that is precisely the time when we must redouble our efforts and rekindle the fire and warm our relationship at the hearth of marriage commitment. USA Today, in its October 19th, 1984 issue, had an interesting analysis that talked about the different times of marriage and which were the best and which were the worst. They say that people in their 30s and 40s tend to experience the least happy years of their marriage, that people in their 50s and 60s often describe that as the happiest time of their lives and their marriages, and those in their 70s and 80s say that things just get better and better. Well, what do you do if you are in one of those winter seasons, one of those winter seasons of marriage when the flame of love may be burning a little bit low and perhaps even flickering out? What do you do? How do you fall in love again? Well, I suppose it begins with learning to love. I invite you to take a look with me in the New Testament to Titus chapter 2, examining for just a few moments verses 1 through 4. An interesting four verses, saying that as for you, that is Titus, teach what befits sound doctrine. Bid the older men be temperate, serious, sensible, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Bid the older women likewise to be reverent in behavior, not to be slanderers or slaves to drink. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children. Now, there are a lot of interesting things in those four verses. Old men are to love. I wonder how old the old men were. If we were to guess in terms of life expectancy in that first century, we might discover that that which we call middle age, which I discover many people defining as older and older. Obviously, some people expect to live to be around 150, 160 years old, the way they define middle age. But for us, middle age, in the late 30s, the 40s, maybe the 50s, is perceived to be that mellow and middle time of life. But for people, I suppose, in that first century where life expectancy was so much shorter, that might well have been the older men who needed to be taught and reminded to love. And the older women, they here in Titus 2, are charged to instruct or teach the young women to love their husbands and their children. Now, the assumption here is that love is not something that just happens. That love is something that is learned, something that is taught. When I meet with couples who are anticipating marriage, one of the standard questions that I often ask them is to tell me about couples who have influenced their view of marriage. And most often, the answer has to do with his parents and with her parents. But oftentimes, it is also other marriages that have surrounded them. I find most often that there is one of two reactions. Either young couples anticipating marriage say, I want to have a marriage much like my parents or those other significant marriages in my life. Or I am in such reaction to what I have seen in growing up and that which has been typical in my home and around me that that's not the kind of marriage I want to have, and I want to have a completely different type of marriage. One of the things that I often do in premarital counseling, and we have often done in our premarital seminar, is to suggest to couples that they take a look at the marriages around them and that they analyze them, that they take note of things like how husbands treat wives, whether they are courteous and kind, whether they open the car door or whether they expect to have the car door open for them, of whether or not the wife speaks of her husband in kind and loving terms, or whether she tends to belittle him and to ignore him, whether or not he is treated with respect, whether or not love is characteristic of their marriage. In fact, I often suggest to Wooddale couples that when you come to church on Sunday morning, you take note of the other couples in the parking lot as you drive up, that you look around you in church at couples and the way they relate to one another in the hallways and in classrooms and in the worship service, that you analyze them and you talk about that together. You take a look at the marriages that you would like to have your marriage be like. Well, that's a principle for all of us, not just for those anticipating marriage, but for those who are already married, that we find the kind of teachers who are lovers and who are good at it, that we look for couples who have strong love, and that we get to know them. Not only do I not think it inappropriate, I think it a wise step to take for married couples to check out in the selection of their friends those who have the kind of marriages that they would like to see modeled in their marriage, to get together with those couples socially and maybe even formally, and to ask them how they did it. Ask them how they cope with the struggles of their marriage. Ask how they dealt with uncertainties in finances. Ask how they went about the strains of raising children. Ask how they responded to an extramarital affair. Find out what they did that was successful, and then model your marriage after them. Find godly men and women who have depended upon Jesus Christ, who have made prayer the routine of their marriage, who have done many of the things that we have searched out in Scripture and in common sense over the last three Sunday nights. People that aren't just talking about it, but people who are actually doing it. And then get close enough to them to learn from them. Be influenced. Influenced by finding teachers who are lovers and lovers who can teach you. It may not even be a flesh and blood person that you see right close up. It may be in the form of books. So perhaps by going to a Christian bookstore, you can read a How to Do It book or maybe even a biography of a marriage. And so you can be influenced by others, recognizing that we are all significantly and powerfully influenced by systematic exposure to good marriages. It's true, you know. if we surround ourselves with the kind of people that we would like to be like, then the chances increase significantly that we will in fact be like them. But there's another side to it as well, and that is that we avoid negative examples. I once worked for a company where the annual Christmas party was something of a marathon event in suggestiveness and immorality. The liquor flowed. The matching up of couples for the evening was quite typically not husband and wife together, but one man with another man's wife and one wife with another's husband. It was a sad picture of unloving marriages. And stories that came back to the company offices the next day and the next week, and the repercussions were really pathetic to hear and to see. That's why Charlene and I decided early, I think it was in the first year of our marriage, that we would not participate in that. Not because we were some kind of prudes, but because we recognized that those were not the kind of influences that we wanted in our marriage and in our lives. Frankly, the same thing goes for a lot of the soap operas and television programs which we tend to use to fill our time, many of which do not uphold a love that is based upon commitment, but rather elevate a love that is primarily emotion and a physical relationship that is primarily based upon sexual attraction and anything really but what the Scripture teaches of what a marriage should be. So we need to learn. We need to learn because that's a biblical principle. We need to learn from marriages which have influenced us for good or for ill. We need to learn by finding people who are good at loving one another in marriage and asking them and learning from them, following their model and their example, and by following or avoiding, rather, the negative examples which are quite easy to find. What else can we do? Well, we can also pray to love. I'll not ask you to look at these verses again because we've studied them on previous Sunday nights, but you'll recall that in 1 Peter 3:7, there was a clear link established between a man's marriage and his prayers. And you recall in James 5:16 that the prayer of a righteous man has great power in its effects. Now what this is spiritual advice for us as Christians. Spiritual advice. You see, if I were a secular marriage counselor, I might, not based upon Christian faith but on practicality, suggest to a couple that wants to fall in love and strengthen their marriage that they pray about it, especially if they be religious people. Probably because I would think that that would be some form of self-suggestion. And if they prayed, that would then reinforce the whole concept in their minds. But as a Christian, as someone who is committed to God and to the instruction of Scripture, I see prayer as far more than something that is auto-suggestion. I see prayer as the powerful tool that God has given to us. And I really believe that prayer makes that significant difference in our lives because I believe that God does hear us and that God does answer us. And we are Christians here tonight. That's why we are here. Because we have come together as part of the family of God. And I would think the likelihood very high that those of us that come on a Sunday night to a church gathering are those who are committed as followers of Jesus Christ and who believe in prayer. And so we ought to pray. And I think pray often that the love in our marriages be strong and growing. Sometimes, though, even as Christians, we are more prone to pray that our spouse will change. We're more prone to ask that God will help her to love me better rather than to help me to love her more. What is a better way to pray? Well, let me give you some specific examples. You might, for example, pray and say, Lord, God, help me to see her beauty. Give me eyes and desires for her and for no one else. You know the old adage that says that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You don't have to be too long around people to discover the profound truth of that. There have been times when I have talked to men who have described their wives in terms slightly less complimentary than one might give to a house pet, and then seen the wife. And I would think her to be gorgeous and wonder why he doesn't see her beauty. And the other side of it is, I have had husbands describe their wives to me, frankly, as if they were the most beautiful women in all of the world. Beautiful, plural on husbands and plural on wives. Most beautiful women in all of the world. And I've wondered, well, she must be absolutely magnificent to behold. And then I've seen her. And I've wondered about his judgment. But you see, it is true that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. There is no absolute standard as to who is beautiful and who is not. It is that which we determine for ourselves. And so we ought pray that God will show us the beauty that he has created in the person to whom we are married. Or we might pray, Lord, help me to overcome the barriers in my life that might hinder my husband or my wife from loving me fully. Many times we have all of our idiosyncrasies, our habits, our things that are part of our personalities in our lives, which stand in the way of making us easy to love. I wonder if we are not more prone to pray, Lord, help her or help him to love me in spite of the way I am, when maybe instead we ought pray, Lord, somehow change me. Give me the power to see the things in me that are unlovely, and change me, Lord, so that I will be more lovable, easier to love. And we might pray, Father, teach me how to love, and love through me. Make me the kind of good lover that you want me to be. Grow me in our loving relationship together in marriage. Those are prayers that I think every devout Christian ought pray, and not just on an occasion, but as a regular discipline. And frankly, they could be among the most important and powerful prayers of any Christian husband or wife's life. So that instead of assuming that love is some kind of uncontrolled emotion that just happens to us, that we pray for love to be that marvelous gift from God that grows and changes and is different. Could I suggest to you a 30-day plan? A 30-day plan that you pray those kinds of prayers about yourself, the way you love, the way you see him, the way you see her. Try it for 30 days. And I will predict that you may well discover the link between speaking in prayer and falling in love. Well, we can learn to love and pray to love. But also, we must decide to love. There's a mistaken notion that is very popular in our society that says that it is love which produces commitment. When asked why they're getting married, many couples will very quickly, almost glibly, say, we're getting married because we love each other. But few human beings have the kind of love that can sustain them through the tests that the typical marriage goes through. Love is merely, really, it's merely what primes the pump. It's really what gets it going in relationship and then generates the commitment. And the commitment, in turn, is what generates the greater love. The first car that I ever owned was a 1941 Plymouth Coupe, which seldom started by itself in the wintertime. And frankly, it seldom started much very well in the summertime either. And so I used to keep a can of gasoline. I know that's not good wisdom, and I didn't know all the things you shouldn't do, but I kept a can of gasoline up in the front. Actually, it was a coupe. It only had a front. So I had the can of gasoline there. Whenever I wanted to start the car, I would pull the hood release, go around, and at first I used to take off the air filter, but I got over that. I just never put it back on because I always had to go around, and I would pour gasoline right into the carburetor. And usually it worked. I do have a scar on my hand from one time. It didn't work quite as it was supposed to work. And I would pour it in and then run around and then, I was going to say turn the key. Actually, on that car, it was one of those starters that was a plunger on the floor right above the gas pedal. And I'd push that thing down, hit it hard, and it would start to turn. And then it would engage the fuel pump, which wasn't in very good shape, and that would then suck the gasoline out of the tank and up to the engine, and then it would fire, and then the fuel pump would run okay, and then it would continue to run. Now, it's kind of like that in the relationship, in a lot of relationships, that it takes something to get it primed, to get it going. And that may be the infatuation. That's when a guy sees a girl. That's when there's that physical and maybe spiritual and emotional attraction. It's that puppy love, that beginning love, that initial drawing together. Not sufficient to keep anything running. It's that which primes it so that it can get started, and it can draw then the resources from that tank of commitment. And it's when we are drawing on that commitment that our marriages then continue to run. Love at the beginning, infatuation perhaps, primes the engine of relationship, but it is that continuing supply of commitment which keeps it going. Now, commitments then need to be strong enough to control feelings. There are days when I don't feel like doing some of the things that I've committed to do. There have been, I must admit, some Sundays when I didn't feel like coming to church. Charlene has always been a great encouragement to me in that particular area. There have been a few Sundays when I have thought, wouldn't it be interesting to just come and sit in the back and just listen and see what happens? And at least one of the services on Sunday, I mean, one out of three on the Sunday morning, it probably wouldn't matter if I were to do that. But, you know, I can't go on the basis of how I feel. It's not a matter of whether I'm tired or feel like it, because I've made a commitment. I've made a commitment to you, and I've made a commitment to God, and it is that commitment which not only keeps me going, but it is also that commitment which enables me to love what I do. Likewise, there are days when I don't feel like being a parent, when I've thought about sending them all back. There have been days when I have thought to myself, I don't want to take care of someone. I want somebody to take care of me. It seems to me that it's about my turn to have somebody worry about me and to pay my bills and to do things on my behalf and take responsibility for me. But I have a commitment. I have a commitment as a father, a commitment to care for them and to provide for them, a commitment to see them through to adulthood. And as someone reminded me this morning, when children reach adulthood, the commitment and the responsibilities and the relationships do not end, but many times increase and then continue. It is that commitment then, that strong commitment, which is necessary to discipline fickle feelings. And the same is true in marriage. Of course there are days when probably most people who are married don't feel like being married. There are some days that are less romantic than others, but it is the commitment, the decision that is made, that keeps a marriage going. And it is that commitment then that disciplines the emotions and enables love to be strong, and enables love then to grow. Ruby Felice is a lady, 78 years old. She's been married 54 years. She and her husband live in Fort Worth, Texas. She was recently interviewed for a newspaper article, and she had, I think, a pretty clear understanding of this whole business of deciding, of making a commitment, and out of it grows love. She says that the most difficult time of their 54 years of marriage was that time when she was raising two quarreling children while her husband, who was an oil company executive, was away most of the time. Not all that dumb, apparently. Yeah. Anyway, she explained how she got through it and how their marriage now, after 54 years, is so good and so strong. She said, "We never thought that the marriage wouldn't go on and on." They had a commitment together. Now, it is out of that commitment that the renewal of love comes. So the renewal of love begins with the renewal of commitment. Those who want their love to grow must decide that they want their love to grow. Those who want their marriages to be strong must decide for marital strength. When people say that they've fallen out of love, that is something that simply does not make sense to me. That's simply not correct. It is not just the emotions. It's a decision that has been made. It didn't just happen. If someone fell out of love, then they decided to fall out of love. And if they have fallen into love with someone else, it is because they have decided to fall into love with someone else. Now, if the decision is all that important, and I believe that it is, then we must decide to love. And if in your marriage your love has been lessening, then you must make a conscious decision for yourself and for your marriage, but most of all for God, a conscious decision to a new commitment and to a renewed love. I'd suggest, in the simplest of terms, setting aside a little bit of time today or tomorrow or this week at the latest, and making that kind of firm commitment to decide that you will love as you have never loved before, to decide that that commitment is for keeps, to decide that you will have an attraction, a desire, a passion that is stronger than ever before, that you will decide to fall in love again. And if you do, if you really make that decision and really make that commitment, you will love more and love better than ever you have before in your life. Learn to love, pray to love, decide to love, and romance to love. It was a wife of 25 years who was out in her yard one day and looked across the street as a newlywed couple had the husband drive up right in front of the house. The wife came running out the front door, ran to her husband, threw her arms around him, embraced him, and they stood there for an embarrassingly long time, kissing and embracing and snuggling and hugging and all kinds of things, until she got over her embarrassment, and then she got the message. So she decided that she would do that to her husband of 25 years. And when he arrived home from work, she did precisely the same thing. Came running out the door, threw her arms around him and kissed him passionately, and stood there and embraced him. And to her delight, did not have some kind of rebuff, but found that that was the beginning of the renewal of the romance of their love. Several of our survey results of a couple of weeks ago indicated that what people were most looking for in their marriage was courting again. Getting back some of those days before marriage or in the early years of marriage when there was that romance, that thoughtfulness, that tenderness, that very special relationship with all of its wonderful actions that continually say, I really care, you're really special, I really love you. What are those things for you? What are those thoughtful, maybe silly things that you used to do that added romance to the relationship? Going out for dinner at a special place, maybe a walk in the woods, maybe a love note on a scrap of paper. It doesn't have to be something expensive, and it doesn't have to be something fancy. It just has to be something special, something loving. Now, for Charlene and me, you may never guess what for us is romantic. For us, romance is a meatball sandwich. Now, that may be, for you, the strangest of all symbols of romance, but a couple of days after our marriage, on our honeymoon in Hyannis, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod, late one night, we decided, let's go out and see if there's any restaurant open. And we went and visited a restaurant outside of town on the highway, a little Italian drive-in place, and there we shared a meatball sandwich together. A restaurant that we have on every opportunity whenever we're back in New England gone to see again. It has changed through the years, but even now, whenever we have a free opportunity, when somewhere, sometime, we can get away and we can do something special, I do not buy for her a dozen roses. I buy for her a meatball sandwich. And that has become for us one of the symbols of romance. Well, you see, in years of marriage, it's easy for all of us to take one another for granted. It's easy to live all of life in the routine. It's easy to forget the things that are special and important, the things that romance and that touch the heart. Maybe most frightening of all is that when you have lived with someone over the years, you get to know that person so well that you not only are able to do the romantic things that touch the heart, but you are able to do the painful things that also touch the heart. You know how with a glance or with a word, or even without a glance or without a word, to prick the other person deeply and inflict a pain that is days and maybe even a lifetime getting over. It's the decision again. The decision to romance. Imagine starting all over again in your relationship with him, with her. Seek to impress her. Do the things that please him. Dress and think and plan ordinary and wonderful things, all of which say, you're special. You are really special. You're the most special person in all of my world to me. What might you do? Well, think for a moment. Think, what are the things that you've done in the past? What might be the three most significant, specific actions that you have taken, I would hope in recent days, to add romance to your marriage? What have you done? But more important than that, think for a moment of three romantic things that you might do. Ways of saying, you know, I take seriously what God calls me to do in our marriage. Not that I think that romance will make the marriage good, but that that romance will be a reflection of the commitment that I have made to you before God. You see, commitment is that solid nutritional base for marriage, but romance is that which adds the spice. Got your list? The three that you might do for the renewal of love in your marriage? Now, there has been one big unanswered question that has sort of floated through all the things that have been said in the last 30 minutes or so. It is the question that goes like this. What if I am the only one who wants to fall in love again? Loving alone is hardly the ambition of very many people. And surely there are many who may have said to themselves tonight, if he would do all of this, then I could love him again. Or I hope that she's listening, because that would bring romance back again. That would change it all. That would make the difference that we need in our relationship. But perhaps sadder than these are those who may have thought, you know, if I brought home some roses, if I took her out to dinner, certainly if I bought her a meatball sandwich, she'd probably either laugh at me or she'd get mad at me. She'd say, you shouldn't spend the money. She wouldn't like it if I were to do some of those things. It would be misunderstood. Or else someone else might have said, well, you know, I've tried that. I've tried those kinds of things. I've done it before. It hasn't done any good. And I'll tell you frankly, I just can't stand to be rejected again. I can't take another hurt. I can't stand to be humiliated. Not one more time. Well, it all comes to a conclusion. The assumed conclusion that you can't love alone. But can't you? A fascinating scripture is that which is written in 1 John 4:19. It's speaking of the love of God for us and teaches us that we love because he first loved us. That's the message of the gospel. The message that God loved us even when we didn't love him back. It's the message that God was kind to us, even when we sinned right in his face. It's the message that God pursued us, even when we ran the other direction. It's the message that God was committed to us, even when we wanted nothing to do with him. You see, God decided. He decided to love us. He made that kind of commitment to us. And then he acted in accord with the commitment that he had made. And he did it totally independent of whether we loved him back or not. He loved us into loving him. And that is the greatest truth of falling in love again. That even if the other person doesn't want to love us back, that we follow in the example of God who loved us into loving him. Wives, husbands, learn to love. Love as you have learned from God. And pray to love. Pray every day that you will be a better lover, that the hindrances will be removed. Pray every day that God will give you that special relationship to that person to whom you're married. And then decide to love. Do not let fickle emotions be the ruler of your life, but make the commitments the ruler of your emotions. Decide that that's what you're going to do and the way you're going to do it. And then romance to love. Express it. Express the commitment, the answers to prayer, the lessons learned. And romance to love again. That is the way to fall in love again. And that is the way to love another person into love with you. Well, our series on marriage has come to an end, a conclusion. And I'd like to suggest that we conclude with an opportunity to renew our marriage vows. Charlene and I are going to share those marriage vows together. I'm going to ask her to come up here, and I'm going to invite you to join with us, as many married couples as would like to invite you to come.